Good to see everyone here this morning. As I said, if you slipped in a little bit late, we're doing something different today. It's called FAQ, and we're going to, instead of a normal message, we're just going to look at some tough questions that you've asked, that some people sent questions in, emailed us, or sent questions in on our website earlier this week. A lot of you wrote down questions as you walked in this morning. And so before we jump into that, let me just say a couple things before we do that. First, you'll have to bear with my voice. I've been a little under the weather the last couple of days, so I've got a little bit of tea up here. And if I start coughing, just be patient. Second, I want to let you know, we're not going to, what I say, I guess, today, when I kind of explore some of these questions, is I just want to offer some thoughts on some of them. I want to try to be helpful, and I don't want you to think that whatever I say is like the official position of New Denver Church, because the truth is, we have a statement of faith, and it's core to what we all believe who are part of this church, and it's the Apostles' Creed. And so you can go on our website and take a look at that, and it outlines sort of the central tenets of our faith and what we believe about that. But most of the questions that we ask and most of the questions we wrestle with are things that are a little more fuzzy and that are a little more gray. And so I'm just going to try to offer some help in those and try to offer some of my ideas based on my background and what I think the Bible maybe says or speaks to some of those things. But it's certainly not in a sense of, and this is the authoritative sort of official position of the church on these matters. I'm not so arrogant to think that I've got all the answers. I mean, the truth is, I'm going to get home today, and I'm going to start thinking like, wow, why did I say that in response to that question? Like, if I could do that over, I would say something totally differently. And if Dan got up here and answered some of these questions, or if Stephen got up here and answered some of these questions, they're just as smart and wise and experienced as I am. They would probably even offer some different thoughts or maybe some different ways of thinking through some of these things. And so just say that to start off by saying, this isn't like Q&A, like you have the questions and we have the answers, and that's sort of that, and it's black and white, and that's how it is. It's our goal in doing things like this is to start conversations, not to end them. There's no sense of, and this is the answer, and that's how it is. It's more of a, that's a great question. We all think about that and wrestle with that. And here's some thoughts to start the conversation, but let's keep it going. And talk about this on your way home, and talk about this. Like, these are conversation starters more than anything else. So, with all of that in mind, as I said, I've got some questions that were sent in via email over this past week, and then also some questions that some of you wrote this morning. And there's no rhyme or reason to this. I just sort of trust that God leads me to the right questions or at the right time, and we'll just kind of see how that goes. So, first question is, what type of product does Norton use in his hair? Now, I'm kind of surprised you asked that, Stephen, since you've known me for so long. You should know, and that you signed it. That's strange, Stephen. No, the answer is none. I don't use any product in my hair, so that was an easy one. So we'll go straight from that one to, does free will exist? So that actually, several people wrote that. One person just, does free will exist? Someone else wrote, is there free will, and how does it work with God's plan for each of us? And someone else wrote about freedom and all those kind of things. And it's a great question, because we all know, if you've read the Bible for very long, I mean, it's kind of a churchy question. Outside of church or religion, most people aren't thinking about this or wrestling with it. But once you start getting involved in church and pursuing God and you read the Bible, you come across these verses that make it sound like God is in control and God is sovereign. And at times, it almost seems like God is orchestrating events in human history, or at least in the Bible, it seems that way. And if he was doing that in the Bible, is he doing that in my life, and is he doing that today? And is God orchestrating, or even the big word sometimes, is God predestined certain things to happen? And if you start taking that to its logical conclusions or outcomes or even extremes, if he does predestine, or if he does orchestrate, or if he is sovereign, or he's somehow in control of all those things, and that makes it feel like I'm not in control. I mean, if this was going to happen anyways, and do I have any free will or free say in this? And the truth is, there's no great answers to this question. You know, Christians have wrestled with this for thousands of years. And most Christians are come to the place where they really just believe the Bible upholds both. That in some mysterious way, it seems like, yes, there's times where God is completely sovereign. And somehow something happened that God clearly wanted to happen, and he is behind it and made it happen. And yet over and over and over in the Bible, it also seems fully clear that God says, your life is yours, and your choices are yours. And I'm not going to make you do anything. Like, it is in your hands to live your life as you choose. And I'm going to give you wisdom, and I'm going to try to guide you and steer you and give you lots of insight as to what good choices look like. But at the end of the day, they're your choices. And with that, it's your responsibility as well. And so somehow I try to take the position that I feel like both of those things are true, that God is somehow sovereign over everything that happens, and yet at the same time, he also, yes, he gives me free will, and yes, he gives me responsibility to live my life, and I uphold both of those things. Now, how they work together, I don't know. That's somewhat still a mystery, and it's hard to get your mind around, but I certainly think the answer is not, no, we don't have free will. I mean, the Bible seems so clear that we certainly do, and that he longs for us to sort of take control of our life and then surrender it to him and work with him on a journey of faith through life together in freedom and yet in surrender to what his best plans are for our lives. So I think that's maybe a tentative thought about that one. So here's another question. If Jesus was Jewish, or he was a Jew by birth, why are those that believe in him not Jewish? And where did Judaism and Christianity split? That's a great one, because it's true. Jesus was Jewish. He was as Jewish as they come. Like, he was, I mean, we don't have a picture of him, so, but as far as we can tell, he grew up in a little town in Israel, and all the historical records indicate he was purely 100% ethnically Jewish. And he lived within that ethnicity, and he lived within that worldview, and he had all of the same thoughts about God and the scriptures and all that Jews at that time would have thought. And so his first followers were all Jewish as well. That seems pretty clear. And yet he believed, and they believed, that God was up to something in history, and that what God was up to in history somehow found its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus himself, that he really was this Messiah. That just means anointed one. He was this one that God was sending to bring to fulfillment everything that he was trying to do for Israel and the Jewish people. And so Jesus believed that, and his initial followers believed that, and it changed their lives. But they didn't stop becoming Jewish. So in the early records of the church, we read they still went to the synagogue. They still went to the temple every day. There's even indications they still offered sacrifices at the temple. And they still tried to keep the law. And they still honored Moses. And they did all of the things that Jews would have done in that time. And yet they were almost a subgroup of Jews, because they believed God had actually done something fully significant in this guy named Jesus. That he really was the Messiah. And that called for almost reinterpreting the laws and reinterpreting everything about their faith in light of this new reality that Jesus came to fulfill what God was doing. Now, interestingly, they also came to the conclusion that God wasn't just doing this for Israel. That God had sent Jesus to be a Messiah, not just for Israel, but to be a Savior and a King and his representative and God with us for the entire earth, for everybody, even non-Jews, which were called Gentiles. And so even though the first followers of Jesus were all Jewish and we go to the temple and all those things, they started preaching this good news, this message, to Gentiles. And so there were all kinds of questions this brought up. Well, then do Gentiles also have to go to the temple like we do? Do they have to obey the laws? And actually, you see a lot of the writings in the New Testament are concerned with those kind of questions. And we won't get into all those this morning, but as you read through Paul's letters, you see he's trying to, these Jews who believe in Jesus are also trying to figure out, how do we relate to these new Gentiles who also believe in Jesus, but they're not Jewish? and they don't go to the temple, and they don't think all the same things we do. So a lot of the New Testament is concerned with that. But historically speaking, by about the end of the first century AD, there were a whole lot more followers of Jesus who were Gentiles than there were who were Jews. There was never any definitive split. There wasn't sort of a split between Judaism and Christianity. But just over time, there were a lot more Gentiles. And so all of these people following Jesus just began to call themselves Christians, followers of Christ, or Christ followers. And that became the dominant way of understanding. There were still Jews from time to time, and there still are today. There are ethnic Jews who truly believe that Jesus is the Messiah and yet still follow him and practice their faith within a very Jewish sort of customs and worldview and all of those things. But predominantly, it's mostly people who are not of a Jewish background who are followers of Jesus. So I hope that's helpful. Another question. Let's see here. Okay, let's go over here. How can we make sense of slavery in the Bible? Why are you laughing? That feels like a hard one. Yeah, it's a hard one. And it would be a long answer, but let me just say a couple things about slavery in the Bible, because it's true. As you read the Bible, and Dan preached a sermon, a series a few months ago on Philemon. So I'd actually encourage you to go back and listen, because this issue of slavery is part of this book in the Bible of Philemon. But a few things to just say about slavery. One, slavery in the Bible is very different than our pictures of slavery in the American South and the Civil War and what many of us think of as slavery. So you just have to set aside, those are very different pictures. Slavery in the ancient world was just practiced very differently. So keep that in mind. Also, keep in mind that the definitive event of the entire Old Testament is what? Is God rescuing Israel from slavery. It's God redeeming and delivering people from true slavery in Egypt. So if anything, that should tell us a little bit about how God views slavery. Now, he never makes it totally explicit. And there's other things that make it feel like, well, maybe God doesn't mind slavery, because once the people of Israel come into the promised land, then they have slaves, as was common. And they go into wars against other people. And whenever the victor won in a war, it was just everybody. That's what they did. You took the other people you defeated as slaves or servants. Again, not in sort of the American South kind of way, but it was still slavery. I mean, it was still bondage. And so... even though all that's going on, just don't forget the definitive thing that God speaks to in the Old Testament and in the Bible is rescuing from slavery. Now, there are a lot of the laws of Israel in the Old Testament that were very kind towards slavery, much kinder than every other law we have from the ancient Near East. Slaves were included as part of the household. Slaves were asked to take part in the celebrations, particularly Passover and the festivals. In other words, they were seen as much a part of the society as everyone else was, which is totally different than every other society in the ancient Near East at the time. So it's almost as if in the Old Testament, God rescues the people from slavery, and then he says, when you practice this in your own way, I want you to practice it differently. It's going to look very differently the way you do it. Then we get to the New Testament, and there's every indication that God is saying all of the barriers that we as humans put up between us and one another, I want to tear those down. And so even, there's this famous verse in Galatians, Paul writes it, and he says, if people are in Christ, new things are happening. He says, therefore, there's no more slave and free. There's no more Jew and Gentile. There's not even any more male or female. And there's the sense that he's not saying there's, like, you're not a male or female anymore. I mean, you still are. But it's almost like he's saying God's new creation has broken in, and the good news is transforming our world so much, and it's transforming our human relationships so much that it should change the way we think about all human relationships. For slavery and free people, it should change the way we think about economics. It should change the way we think about differences in races. I mean, it should challenge racism. It should change the way we do think about men's and women's roles and all of those kind of things. And so there's almost like a redemptive arc to the Bible that maybe it never comes out at the very end and says, and therefore what I want you to do is never have slaves and always fight against slavery, and that's what Jesus would want you to do. It never explicitly says that, but as you read through, you get the sense that Jesus is saying the good news speaks to everything in life. And I want you to begin to live that out in all of your relationships, particularly maybe even those where there's sort of authoritarian power at work. So I think maybe that's one way of making sense of slavery in the Bible. I don't know if that's helpful. That's a lot to think about. But let's move on. Let me ask another one. Are there certain concepts you have to, and that's underlined, you have to believe to be a Christian? That's a good one. What do you guys think? Pass it around. If we had a smaller group, that's probably what we'd do. It would be actually a lot more fun for this to be a true dialogue. I don't know. You know, I think what's behind that question, I don't know what's behind it. I think one of the things that's behind it, when I've asked that question, and I still ask it, is what do you have to intellectually believe? Like, if you put a group of statements on a page, like 200 statements, what are the bare minimums that I would have to agree to? What are the doctrines I have to hold, or the belief statements I have to believe? And I just honestly think the Bible and Jesus was a whole lot less concerned with what we intellectually believe than what we do with our lives. And there's even this sense that belief isn't what you just cognitively believe. That's part of it. But belief should work itself out in your actions and the way you live your life. And if it doesn't, then that kind of really says what you believe. So James talks about this. Like, if you believe something in your head, but it doesn't influence your actions, and that's not real faith. That kind of faith is almost, it's just dead faith, because it's not living. It doesn't live itself out. And so I think that should just change and make us tentative about coming up with, here's the four things, or here's the 10 things you have to believe in your head. It doesn't devalue those, but you know, Jesus walked around, and what did he say to every single person he came in contact with? He never said, here's what I want you to believe. He talks about belief. It's important. What did he say? Follow me. Follow me. Like that, over and over and over, that's what he said. And there's a sense that what it means to be a Christian is just to be a follower of Jesus. And there's places in your life, so that's a journey. That's a journey. It takes your whole life doing that. Now, there are definitive points in your life where you come face to face with some beliefs you have to figure out. Do I believe Jesus is the Son of God? Do I believe what he said was true? Do I believe what the Bible says about him is true? And those are important questions, but I think they can't be separated from everything else. They're all wrapped up in this idea of just follow me, and it's going to take time. And the disciples, I mean, if you ask them on day two of following Jesus, do you believe this, this, and this? They would probably say, no way. Like, I don't know. But Jesus is patient, and he walks with them. It's just like, just keep following. It's a journey. It's going to be an unfolding journey of belief, and there's going to be days you believe and some days you don't, but just keep following. That's what the Christian life is all about. So that's probably how I would start thinking about that question. Here's another one. I know, somebody wrote this, I know the Christian worldview regarding origins is based on creationism. I'm guessing what they mean by that is sort of this, a certain view of how to understand creation. Does this mean that we as believers should categorically disbelieve evolution and denounce this entire scientific body of work to be untrue? No, I don't. Now, let me say a couple things about this real briefly, but actually I'd say we did a whole sermon series on this a few years ago. It's called In the Beginning. So you can just go to our website and listen, go back and listen to that. Maybe we'll do it again or talk about it another time. But there's a lot we talked about in that. So just go listen to that and you can get the long version. But I would just say, I think science is extremely important. Of course we should listen to what science says. I mean, we listen to what science says when it comes to the laws of gravity, right? I mean, does any of us not believe in the laws of gravity? What about when it comes to medicine? Like, do we think it's valuable that chemists and biologists are getting together and figuring out how do we, is there a way to deal with cancer? Like, we think science is incredibly valuable there. What about physics whenever you get on a plane? Like, you believe in physics, right? You're thankful for physicists who have figured out how to make planes fly. So I just think God says, I've given you the ability as humans to observe nature and learn from it and make human civilization flourish in a better place in light of the way you learn from science and all those kind of things. So I just don't think we should ever devalue it. Now, from time to time, there's going to be scientific discoveries or thoughts that are going to seem like they are in conflict with some of our beliefs as Christians, and that's okay. And so I think whenever that happens, you take a critical eye towards both. You take a critical eye towards what maybe science is saying and some of those discoveries and thoughts, and you ask the question, could that really be true, or are those just tentative, and in 10 years are scientists going to have very different theories about that, and because that's always happening. So you take a critical eye towards that, but you also take a critical eye towards our interpretation of the Bible. Not the Bible itself, just our interpretation of it. So this happened with Galileo. In the 17th century, Galileo comes along, and everyone believed at that time that the earth was the center of the universe. And that was partly just out of what they believed in their limited knowledge of astronomy and how things worked, but it was partly because there were verses in the Bible that talk about the sun rises and sets, right? It was a very Christian culture in Europe at the time, Christendom, and the sun rises and sets, and there's other verses that seem to indicate the earth is at the center of the universe. So Galileo comes along, he says, I'm kind of making some discoveries from astronomy that question that, that says the sun is actually the center of the universe. The earth just rotates around the sun. We've got it wrong. And what did most Christians do at that time? They rejected him. And they said, there's no way, because this is what the Bible says, and we believe it, and that settles it, and you're wrong, Galileo. And it took years for us to come back and realize, no, actually he was right. And it wasn't that the Bible was wrong, it was our interpretation of the Bible was flawed or just incomplete. Now we realize, well, those are just either A, those are just expressions. I mean, we still use those expressions, right? We talk about the sunset and the sunrise. Even though scientifically, that's not correct. We still use those expressions. So those are just expressions, or yeah, that was the limited worldview of the people in Israel when they wrote those. That's how they saw it. That was their worldview. But we now know that's scientifically not accurate, but that's okay. That doesn't raise any significance. We interpret those passages a little bit differently and see them more fully. So I would say when it comes to any issues, and maybe particularly the creation evolution issue, that we just need to take that perspective. Take a critical eye towards what science is saying and ask hard questions about that, do that. But also say, well, let's revisit the way we understand Genesis 1 and 2 and ask the question, maybe there's better ways of interpreting it that don't seem as at odds with what we believe or see from science. So those are just some thoughts on that. Here's another question. Is salvation, it's actually like a four-part question. I'm just going to give you parts 1 and 2. Is salvation the same for everyone who accepts Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior? I struggle with how hard or easy it is for one to be saved and have the gift of eternal life that comes with accepting Jesus. And then there's sort of some examples this person gives. For example, does the thief on the cross next to Jesus, that's from Luke 23, gain entry to heaven the same way someone like a highly pious person does? Can you live your life not knowing or not accepting Jesus and then at the very end simply accept Jesus and all is good? That's a great question. I think that salvation is the same for everybody in the Bible. Because I do think that, I mean, that very one story, if you remember the story, if you haven't heard it, Jesus is hanging on the cross, and one of the thieves next to him looks up at him. One insults him, but the other looks up at him and basically says, yeah, you are the Son of God. And Jesus looks at him and says, today you're going to be with me in paradise. Now, we don't know what this guy's heart and life had been like all up until this point. We don't know. But evidently, at the very end of his life, on his deathbed, he's somehow expressing faith in Jesus, and Jesus is honoring that and saying, yeah, you get it. And you're going to spend eternity with me, whatever that looks like. Which, again, raises this question of, well, what about the person who walked with Jesus their whole life and followed Jesus and gave up sacrificially and all of these things? Is it the same? Jesus actually told a story about this very issue. One day he said, let me tell you a story about some guys who are workers. This guy comes along and he finds somebody at 6 a.m. in the morning. And he says, hey, I'll hire you this today. If you'll work for me the whole day, I'll pay you $500 at 5 p.m. this afternoon. The guy's like, awesome, yeah, I'll do that. And then he goes at 9 a.m. and he finds a different group of guys. He says, hey, if you'll work for me today, I'll pay you $500 at the end of the day. And then he finds some guys at noon. If you'll work for me for the rest of the afternoon, I'll pay you $500. Then he finds some guys at like 3 o'clock. If you'll work, then some guys at 4 o'clock. If you'll work an hour for me, I'll give you $500 at the end of the day. So everybody gathers at 5 p.m. and the guy who is Jesus starts handing out the money. And like, here's $500. And of course, what do you think? The guys that show up in the first thing in the morning are like, whoa, that's totally unfair. I worked all day. And this guy worked an hour, and he got the same thing as I did. And it's almost like Jesus is saying, it doesn't matter. A, the reward is awesome. So you should be thankful for it whenever you started working. Like, it's a great reward. And B, it's the same for everyone. Because I'm the person giving it to you. In fact, the way it works, I think, for us in following Jesus in grace is we didn't even earn it to begin with. So whether I started, you know, then, or I'm the thief on the cross or the very last, it doesn't matter. It wasn't about what I earned or what I did. It was just about this gracious gift from Jesus himself to me. Now, there is another, I think, question that comes up. Well, so why don't we all just wait till the very end of our lives, you know? Well, in some ways that's flawed because, A, if you wait, you probably won't even be open at the end of your life. In other words, if for your entire life you've been saying no to Jesus and sort of rejecting him and saying, no, I don't think your plan for my life is as good as my plan for my life. I think I can live it better than... I think I can live my life apart from you now better. I mean, if you say that your whole life, at the end of your life, why would you even be open at that point? Your heart will probably be so hard because you'll have lived your entire life rejecting God that you won't even be asking that question at the end of your life. So I don't think it's going to happen. But secondly, it also makes salvation or this eternal life thing all about just what happens when you die. And what if that's not what it's fully about? What if Jesus is coming to all of us now and saying, hey, if you follow me, you'll experience life the way you were meant to experience it. Right now, in this life, it's not about eternity. I mean, that's like, that's just the outcome. That's just the result, but that's not the goal. The goal is you living your whole life, here and now and in eternity, in the best way possible, in the way that aligns with what I've designed you for and I've made you for. And I want to bring redemption and restoration and peace and shalom and grace and all these things into your life right now. I think that's the invitation of Jesus. Not just, hey, I hope sometime you'll accept me so you can go to heaven when you die. I mean, if that's the case, then yeah, put it off till the very end. But if it's bringing God's grace and restoration and redemption and meaning and purpose into our lives by following him, then I think it's, man, we're all faced with that question every single day. And are we going to give our lives over to following him? So just a few thoughts about that one. Let's move on. How much, whoa. Okay, skipping that one. Are you going to expand on last week's message? That's a quick one. No, I'm not going to. Go back and listen. We had, there was just a message last week. But Dan is. So Dan's going to be doing a series in a couple weeks, and he's actually going to unpack a few of the things we talked about last week, but a lot more practically. How do we live out the mission we feel like God has given us, and how do we live out the message? If the gospel message is way bigger than most of us have ever thought, if the good news is really that good, how do we tell and live it out and share it with our city and with our world and the people we know? Okay, one more. I couldn't pass this one up because we've been talking about this on staff. Is consuming marijuana a sin? Does the fact that marijuana is legal in our state change or affect whether consuming it is a sin? I actually think it's a good question, right? I mean, some of us have probably thought about this since all the laws have changed. The first thing I'd just say is, whenever we talk about is X a sin, remember this. Paul says this in Romans 14, anything that's not done in faith is a sin. Like anything that's not done with Jesus, anything that's done in our own strength or apart from God is a sin. And so the truth is, it's easy for us to sort of categorize which sins are the worst. And we've all got those thoughts of which sins we think are the worst in our society, and we want to speak to those. But anything apart from faith in God is a sin. And in fact, Jesus talked about greed and pride and anxiety. I mean, he talked about those things way more than he talked about all the other things that we think are the worst sins. So that should just sort of set the table. But that said, let's talk about marijuana for a second. I think it fits into a larger category, quite simply. I mean, we all know this, of just mind-altering substances. And so what it says when you smoke marijuana is, I just want an escape. Like, I want something that's going to provide an escape for me, that's going to alter my mind chemically and provide. And we do that with alcohol at times. People do that with all sorts of things. And I think it's just this faith issue of anything that you do apart from finding sort of the peace and the rest and the wholeness that we can find in Jesus and from God, anything you do that you think is going to broker that or bring that to you apart from God is probably a sin. And so, I think using drugs in that way is probably a sin. Now, marijuana is different from, like, alcohol because you don't really do it in moderation. Like, nobody, with alcohol, like, someone might go home and drink a half a glass of wine because they really enjoy wine and they think it tastes good and they have all these vintages and all those kinds of things, and that's different. Nobody, like, smokes a half a joint because they like the taste of it. You know, people smoke marijuana to get high. And so that does probably put it in a different category than alcohol and makes it sort of a mind-altering substance. And so for us, I think it seems pretty clear. It's just unhealthy. It leads us away from finding the kind of life and peace and all the things that we're seeking out with God. So that'd be how I would think about that. Now, here's one thing we want to do. That's just a few questions. We'll address some more tonight. If you want to come back, we'll talk about different ones tonight. But here's how we want to move into the end of our service. We're going to do something that doesn't seem like it actually is paired up with FAQ very well. We're going to take communion now. And we do this regularly. If you're a visitor or you're a newcomer to New Denver, we do this once a month. Some churches do it every week. Some do it less frequently. But we do it because it Jesus' last meal before he went to the cross. He shared bread with his disciples. But before passing it out and just starting to dig in and eat the bread, he said, hold on a second. This is different tonight. This bread represents my body broken for you, and this cup, this wine, represents my blood spilled for you. And so we remember that by taking this meal together. We take the bread, and we keep it simple here. We just have gluten-free bread, and we have grape juice back there, and we make our way to the back and just take a piece and dip it in the juice. But it's our way of remembering what Jesus did, and it's our way of remembering and reenacting the grace and the love that he offers, and almost proclaiming once again to ourselves. As we do that this morning, I want you to keep two stories in mind real quickly. One is the story of Thomas. After Jesus died and rose from the grave, he appeared to all the disciples. And they all believed in Jesus, but for some reason, Thomas wasn't there that day. And so all the disciples came to him and they said, hey, we saw Jesus. He rose from the grave. And Thomas is like, I'm not buying it. I don't believe it. And then John tells us, is in chapter 20, he tells us the next week they're gathered together and Thomas is there with them. And Jesus comes and he interacts with Thomas. But I think what's so amazing is Thomas is still there. He's gathered with followers of Jesus. He is a follower of Jesus. They still sing songs together. Maybe they even took communion together, but Thomas still has huge doubts, huge questions. He's not fully sure what he believes, but he's still there asking and seeking out. There's another guy that Jesus interacts with, and it's his father and his son. And his son has these horrible diseases afflicting him. He's deaf and he's mute and he has these horrible seizures. And he comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, can you heal my son? And Jesus says, well, it's not a question of can I heal him. In fact, the better question is, do you believe I can? And the father says, I believe, but help my unbelief. There's almost a sense of the father saying, I have some belief, but it's like that much. It's like the tiniest shred. And I've got a lot of questions and doubts and a whole lot of unbelief. And it's almost as if Jesus heals his son. And Jesus, it's almost like Jesus is saying, you know what? That's enough. Just that much belief is enough. Because on the rest of the journey, we'll work on all of the other questions you've got. And so the band's going to come up, and we're going to sing a song. And if you want to, you don't have to participate, but if you're new, the table's open to anyone. And I'd love for you to just think about those stories as you walk up to the table today, and almost in your heart simply say this. As you take the piece of bread and dip it in the juice, almost in your heart be saying, God, I believe in your son Jesus. I believe that he gives the grace and love that I need. But I've still got a lot of doubts, and I've still got a lot of questions. And so I'm just coming to you. Would you continue to help me on this journey of faith? Would you continue to help me with whatever lack of belief I still have? Let me pray. God, that's our prayer this morning. Give us the faith to bring our doubts and questions to you. Thank you for making sure we would never question your love by just sending your son for us. Help us to just remember what he did on the cross for us today. And at the very least, trust you with that. I pray this in your name.